Hi, everybody. My name is Pat Yo, and I'm an alcoholic. That introduction is actually sort of funny today because I almost was late to the meeting. I'm sitting here watching the news on TV. I wrote down 5 o'clock. I told a friend of mine the meeting was 5 o'clock, but I was thinking in my mind it was 5:30. And then Jerry texted me and said, "Can you log on?" I'm like, "Oh my God." So a little quick run to put something up. Yeah. Anyway. Thank you, Jerry. It's always nice to be of service, especially to help you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. I love the way I get to live my life today as a result of being a sober participating member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started, excuse me, I started drinking when I was 13. I was at a party that night and people were drinking, so I drank. And the magic happened. You know, it changed how I felt about everything, me, you, everything. I like to describe it that I feel like I relaxed for the first time, really relaxed for the first time in my life. I was always pretty tense and uptight and very self-conscious and, you know, just thought about myself all the time. And I'm at this party and I drank some rum and Coke and that just went away. I just felt good, you know, more than good, you might say. I danced, felt like the best dancer there. I could talk to people, said funny things that made people laugh. I drank too much, of course, because that's what we do. And I blacked out and passed out. And I came to the next morning in bed with a Marine that I didn't know, which was way, way more than I meant to do that night. You know, my 13-year-old girlfriends knew where my evening had ended up. And I was embarrassed and ashamed. I was terrified I'd get pregnant. Had a lot of bad feelings about that night. But when I came to the next morning, I couldn't wait to do it again. The drinking part. I couldn't wait to do it again. You know, I just... as it turned out, I did all of it again and again and again. You know, that first night kind of set the tone for what my drinking was going to look like. As I describe it, when I drink, I become friendly. And so I developed a reputation in high school for being the friendly girl. And that's not a reputation any girl wants. I certainly didn't want it. I knew people were talking about me. It embarrassed me. It made me feel bad. But I don't ever remember thinking during that time, gosh, maybe if I didn't drink, you know, I wouldn't do these things. I don't ever remember that thought crossing my mind. And so so it just continued on until my parents sent me away to boarding school for my last couple of years of high school because they were understandably very concerned about how I was living my life. And so they sent me off to this all-girls school. And, you know, I graduated and I went off to a local college. And I got married at the end of that first year of college because somebody asked. He was a really nice guy. He deserved better than what he got. I remember walking down the aisle on my dad's arm thinking, this might be a mistake. Now, I'm pretty sure that's not what you should be thinking at a moment like that. But I just marched down and said, I do. And it was a mistake. You know, it really was a mistake. I was not married material. I left him after 6 months. It was kind of this is the excuse I used for most of my life, well into sobriety. We were married about 6 months, and my brother, my only brother growing up, was in the Navy. He was a couple years older than me. He was in the Navy at the time, and he was very badly injured in an accident on board his ship. The ship was in Japan at the time. And so they took him off the ship, and they put him in a hospital in Japan. And the Navy Department, or whoever does this sort of thing, was sending telegrams to my mother, updating her regularly on he was very badly injured. And nobody in our family could afford to go there. So I just started sending him cards every day, hoping to cheer him up. You know, he's in a foreign country, doesn't speak the language, he's badly injured. So I'm sending him these cards, but mostly funny cards, trying to cheer him up. And about a month went by and my mother got noticed that he was improving enough. They thought that they would be able to ship him back to the States. And we were all very excited about that. And so I sent another one of these cards. On the front, it said something like, heard you were ailing, but not to worry. And then on the inside, it said, only the good die young. I sent it and he died. I could not have felt worse if I had killed him myself. Seriously, I couldn't believe I had sent such a stupid, stupid card. My prayer was the card didn't get there in time. You know, the mail being what it is. Please, God, don't let that stupid card have arrived. When his trunk of belongings got shipped back to my mother, I happened to be at her house that day, and she opened it up, and that card was laying on the top. It had been opened. I took it when nobody was looking. I went in the bathroom. I tore it up in little tiny pieces and flushed it down the toilet and cried and cried and cried. Now, I know, obviously, today from the perspective of being sober a good long while, that my brother knew that I loved him. But I had no tools for anything at that time. I never told anybody about that card until I did an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was so ashamed about it. It was just the first of many more things that were to become the secrets that I was going to walk around with, you know. I'm crying all the time about my brother, and my poor husband said to me one day, I don't know how to help you get over the grief about your brother's death. Maybe if you went and stayed with your mother for a little while, she could help you. He was not trying to get rid of me. He was trying to help me. And so I said, okay. And so I went back to my parents' house, and I basically never went back to my husband. He didn't quite know what had happened there. That was not his intention at all. He called and wrote and offered to go to marriage counseling, and I would have none of it, because I remember he asked me, why, what is going on? Why are you not coming back? And I couldn't answer him because they didn't know. I know today from the perspective of being sober a good long while, I blamed it on my brother, you know, on my brother's death for years and years and years. But I know today the reason I left him is we were never going to be drinking enough to satisfy me. We were a young married couple. We had, you know, not much money, and we had to pay rent and stuff. And when we were dating, we drank a lot, but now we can't afford to do that. And so we would do this thing. We'd get together with two or three other couples at one of our houses for an evening, you know, together to play cards or something. And we would buy one bottle of wine. You hear that? One bottle of wine for 6 to 8 people. And we'd mix it with 7-Up or something to stretch it. And that's what we would drink over the course of an entire evening. I needed to drink more than that. I did not know that. I didn't know that was making, you know, setting off a craving in me that was not being fulfilled. I didn't know any of this. Anyway, I left him, and I moved up to LA, which was like 50 miles up the road from where I was living. And I got a job in the apartment. My first job was at a trucking company. My parents were divorced when I was very young. And so my first job in LA was for a trucking company that my actual father was vice president of. And I asked him for a job, and he was reluctant to hire a family member, but I think he felt some guilt over, you know, the divorce and all that. So he hired me. And the understanding was it would be a job for a year, that I could have a, you know, a solid something to put on a resume, and then I would go on my way. And I was great. It was a good opportunity. I was grateful for it. So I went to work there, but I'm an alcoholic. And pretty soon I'm behaving there the way I behaved in high school, which is to say, before I left that job less than a year later, I knew many of those truck drivers in the biblical sense, you might say. Word of my behavior apparently reached up to my dad's office, and he called me one day to talk to me about my behavior. You know, I can't really think about my behavior sober in the morning in the light of day. You know, I can't really think about what happened last night. I most definitely cannot talk to my father about it. And so I said some kind of ugly things to him on the phone that day, just so he'd hang up and quit trying to talk to me about it, which he did. And I quit the job. And I didn't speak to my father again, except twice, once at a wedding, once at a funeral, just because we came face to face and it was kind of necessary to say hello, until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a good number of years later. You taught me how to make amends, and I made amends to him. And as a result of that, I had a good relationship with my father until he passed away a number of years ago now. You gave that to me. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that relationship with my father. I know that I would never have spoken to him again. I simply wouldn't have. So I'm obviously very grateful for that, and so much more. So I left that job. I was a secretary. I was a really, really good secretary. So I never had any trouble getting a job, but I'm an alcoholic, and I behave badly. You know, I drink at lunchtime, and I drink after work with the boss and the clients and the coworkers, and I sleep with everybody, and I create an ugly mess at this company. I mean, you know, it's like high school all over again. They're talking about me, and I have to leave. I've never been fired from a job, but I left when I really got honest about it, looked at it. I left every single job I ever had because of my behavior behind drinking, because I had embarrassed and humiliated myself so much. Here's how I drank. I went out with my boss and my coworkers one night. We're bar hopping around downtown LA, and I was very drunk. I thought everybody was very drunk. Maybe they weren't quite as drunk as me, but we wound up in a strip club, and I auditioned for a job. Now, I'm sitting at this table with my boss and my coworkers, and I'm dressed much as I'm dressed tonight, you know, in a nice outfit that I'd worn to work that day. And I got up from the table to go to the ladies' room, which was down the hall behind the stage. And I bumped into the owner of the bar in the hallway and made some derogatory remarks about the caliber of his entertainment. And he said something along the lines of, hey, if you think you're such hot stuff, go for it. Apparently, I thought that. So, you know, a moment ago, I was sitting there with my boss and my coworkers, as I said, dressed kind of nice. And moments later, I appear on the stage, essentially dressed in nothing. And there was that moment when my boss's eyes and mine met. I happened to be looking directly at him at the instant that he recognized who that was up there on that stage. I will never forget the look on his face. This was like happened well over 50 years ago. I can see his face like it's in front of me right now. It was a moment. That's a job I quit without going back to clean out my desk. You know, you can't face people in the light of day after some of this stuff. You know, office Christmas parties was pretty much guaranteed I'm not going to be showing up after them, you know, because I behaved badly. Now, that whole strip club incident gave me ideas. I was horrified the next morning when I came to and realized what I'd done, but it gave me ideas. Go-go dancing was kind of a thing at the time. I don't know if it was actually a thing. It wasn't in my crowd, but in my mind's eye, go-go dancing seemed classier than stripping. Now, we all know that it's not. It's pretty much the same thing, but I convinced myself that it was, you know, a honorable profession. And so I went and actually got a paid job as a dancer. There were a lot of nice clubs on the Sunset Strip that had dancers. I never worked in a nice club ever. The clubs I worked in were pretty much dives. My first job was in a club on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles. I never met anybody there who spoke English. I have no idea how I got that job. But there I was. And then I moved uptown to a place uptown because they spoke English. This is kind of how I saw it. That the next place was on the outskirts of Chinatown in downtown LA, which is another way of saying it was on the outskirts of Skid Row because they come kind of close together there. And I met the man who was to become my second husband there at Nick's, where I was working as a dancer. He was a customer, possibly the most unsuitable man in the state of California for me. So, of course, we moved right in together and set up housekeeping and eventually did get married. We got married in Las Vegas. We drove to Las Vegas. We sat in the car and drank a pint of something and then went upstairs in the courtroom and got married by a judge who was wearing his bedroom slippers. That's pretty much all I remember about that day. So now I'm married again. And I went back to working as a secretary, gave up my show business career. But I'm, in case you were in any doubt up till now, even I know that I'm a full-blown alcoholic by this point. I'm going to work every day, but I'm drinking every single day. I'm getting drunk every single day. I tried not to drink at lunchtime because when I drink at lunchtime, something bad is going to happen. I'm either going to go back to work, not necessarily good, or I'm not going to go back to work, also not good. And so I tried very hard not to drink at lunchtime, but I did not succeed. I don't know, maybe 50%. I don't know. But whatever I did at lunchtime, when I got off work, I would walk in the front door. Remember, we had a little table right by the front door. I would put my purse on that table. I would walk straight through the living room and the dining room to the kitchen. Scotch is my drink of choice, although I'll drink anything and pretty much have. But assuming we have scotch, I would pick up the bottle of scotch and take a swallow. Now I'm okay. Now I can sort of take a breath and, you know, change out of my work clothes into my purple flannel bathrobe, which was my final drinking costume, and settle in for an evening of drinking. At some point, I would call the liquor store to deliver a new bottle. It's not that I had any great qualms about drinking and driving. I did it often. But as the years were going by, I was getting a little strange and paranoid. And the idea of going out after dark seemed a little frightening if I was already in the house. You know, I dealt with bottle and keg liquor on Pico Boulevard. They delivered. I got to the point where when I came home from work, actually, I would do it before I left work. I would write out the check. It's the same amount every time, a fifth of scotch and two packs of cigarettes. It's virtually and a tip for the delivery guy. It's the same amount of money every day. So I would write out the check at work. This is one of those things I did without really thinking about the fact that I was doing it. And I'd get home from work. I'd put my purse on the table, as I said, by the door, and I'd take that check out and I'd lay it by the purse. because I knew that by the time I called the liquor store and then they delivered, you know, I might not be able to write the check. And so I just did that. You know, sometimes I forgot. Sometimes I passed out. You know, if they were having a busy night and took them a while to get to me, I might have already passed out by the time they got to my door. I was such a good customer that they would actually leave the bag on my porch with the bottle and the cigarettes because they knew I would come down the next morning and pay them. And I always did. I never, ever bounced a check at Bottle and Keg Liquor, but I often had utilities turned off and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I had my priorities straight. Let's face it. You know, it just goes from bad to worse. I started getting arrested. My first arrest was on a Thanksgiving night. I had been to Thanksgiving dinner at my parents' house. My husband wasn't invited. I don't think I mentioned my family was quite unhappy about this marriage, so much so that actually they never met him. We were married for 11 years until he passed away, and they never met him. They felt strongly about it. So he was a chef. He worked at a restaurant in Beverly Hills. His boss, the owner of the restaurant, had a Thanksgiving Day party for all of his employees. So my husband went to that, and I went to Newport Beach to my parents' house for Thanksgiving. I got very drunk at their house that night. I was driving home. I stopped at a bar on the way home on Main Street in downtown LA, which is the heart of Skid Row, to buy some cigarettes. I can't tell you why I picked that particular place, but that's where I decided to buy my cigarettes. So, of course, I had a couple more drinks in there and got my cigarettes, and I came out and got arrested for a common drunk on Main Street in downtown LA. They took me to Sybil Brand, which was the women's institution at the time, and told me I could make a phone call. And I remember where my husband was. So I called the boss's house and the boss's wife answered. And I identified myself and told her that I was in jail. Could she have my husband come bail me out? It did not cross my mind that it might've been nicer to ask to speak directly to my husband to deliver that news. But I never, ever thought about anybody but myself, you know. My second arrest was in Tijuana for obscene dancing. That's all I'm going to say about that. You get the idea. It would be safe to sum up my drinking career to say that I was not drinking like a lady. I spent, I don't know how long, the last few years, I'm so much in blackouts and have such hazy time frame references. I love speakers who say, and then in 1952, I think it was a Thursday. I don't know. You know, stuff happened. But for the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years, I don't know, I pretty much drank in a rocking chair in my living room in a purple flannel bathrobe, calling the liquor store every night. I spent a lot of time, the blinds were always drawn. I spent a lot of time peeking out from the blinds, looking at you. I was worried about you. I wondered what you all were doing. It worried me a lot. I was very afraid. I was very paranoid. I was just strange. Let's face it. I was just really strange. One night I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was drunk when I called. A real nice man answered the phone and asked me if I was having a problem with alcohol. I said that I was, and I started to cry. I was embarrassed about crying, but I was drunk enough that I stayed on the phone anyway. And he talked to me quite a long time, or it seemed like a long time anyway, and told me a lot about himself and told me where a meeting was the following night. And I wrote that down. And the next day when I came to, I thought I'd been a little premature about calling Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 30 years old, and I'm pretty sure that's too young to be an alcoholic, which is kind of a funny thing to say today. I know 30-year-olds that are sober, you know, 20 years. So, you know, maybe not quite that much, but you know what I'm saying. I was considered one of the young people when I got sober. Now, in the light of day, as I said, it seemed a little premature, but I couldn't get it out of my mind all day. And I heard myself say to my husband, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. He didn't care. We were not getting along. We had not been getting along in quite a long while. And so he went off to wherever he went. And I went to my first meeting. It was in the basement of a church in Santa Monica. There were probably 300, maybe 350 people there. It might as well have been 30,000 people. I saw y'all walking down the steps and, you know, talking and laughing like we do. And I thought, there's no way I can get out of this car, but somehow I did. And I walked down those steps and there was a man standing at the door. Excuse me. There was a man standing at the door who put out his hand and said, hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It made me feel welcome. I believe it's the single most important thing anybody ever does in a meeting, because that made me feel welcome. I went in the room and it was an 8:30 meeting. So I got there at 8:28. And because I know I can't talk to you. I didn't drink. The guy on the phone said, don't drink. So I didn't drink that day. By 8:28, I'm sometimes already passed out. So I was not feeling very well by the time I hit the door of that meeting hall. I went in the room. Now it's 8:29, and you're all milling around looking for your seats. And a man came out of the crowd and asked me if I was new. And I couldn't imagine how he knew that in the midst of all these people. But I said yes. And he got me a big book and a seat, and the meeting started. It was a speaker meeting, much like this one. The speaker that night was a man by the name of Norm Alpe, and I heard him. I identified. We actually drank in one of the same places. He was a much older man than I, but I got hope is what I got. I believe that if I, you kept saying, do what we do. I did not have a clue what that was. But I remember thinking, if I do whatever it is they're doing, maybe I can stay sober. But I'll never, ever be able to feel the way that guy feels. He was like this happy, joyous guy. I mean, beyond joyous. You know, I can't get from here to there. But I got enough hope to get me back to another meeting. I drank a couple more times in the next 10 days. And when I went to my second meeting a week later, I raised my hand again for being a newcomer. And I got some phone numbers. I got phone numbers the first night, but I didn't call you. I don't know you. What in the world would I talk to you about? But one of these ladies took the time to sit down and talk to me at the meeting and suggested strongly that I call her. And so I called her a couple of days later. I was drunk when I called her. And she said, you might want to get a sponsor. You're not doing very well on your own. And we've all found sponsors to be pretty helpful. And I said, I don't know what a sponsor is or how to get one. And she said, I'll be your sponsor. She said, you have a big book? I said, yes, I got one at my first meeting. And she said, okay, bring it with you tomorrow night. And come early before the meeting starts and we'll talk about it. And so I did that. The first thing she did is she opened up my big book to the front cover and told me to write that day's date in there. I wrote that date in there. She said, that's your sobriety date. I remember thinking, shouldn't have done this in ink. I don't think that's going to be my sobriety date, but I'm happy to report that it is my sobriety date, August 28th, 1975. The next thing she did is she took the meeting directory and she circled the meeting for every night of the week. I couldn't believe it. I said, oh, excuse me, I can't do this. I'm married. My husband is pretty upset that I'm at this meeting tonight. I definitely can't go to one every night. He would never stand for it. And she said, well, maybe you can do it on less. But she said, let me tell you, it doesn't matter if your husband likes it. It doesn't matter if you like it. She said, I guarantee you, if you come to these meetings every night and take these steps and some simple suggestions that I'm going to give you, your life is going to change. I believe for me, the miracle happened in that conversation. Because I heard myself agreeing to do what she was asking me to do, despite the fact that I knew it was going to cause me a lot of trouble at home, which it did. But I started coming to meetings every night and taking these steps and doing what she told me to do. And, you know, some of the early directions, you know, none of it made sense to me, but I did it because I didn't have a better idea. Thank God I was desperate enough just to say, okay, whatever, you know. My first commitment was washing ashtrays and coffee cups. This is a long time ago. We could smoke in meetings and we had real coffee cups. And so my job was to wash the coffee cups after this one particular meeting. And I didn't want to do it, but she told me to. So I did. Now, I'm unable to talk to you in the meetings. I can't look you in the eye and have a conversation. I am so self-obsessed. So I'm washing coffee cups. And next to me, there's somebody who's rinsing coffee cups. And over there, there's somebody who's drying them. And we would have these little conversations while this work was going on. It wasn't awkward because we're not staring at each other. You know, our purpose is not to have a conversation here. Our purpose is to do these dishes. I didn't know that I was learning how to talk to you. I thought I was just doing the dishes, you know. She told me to start calling three people every day, in addition to calling her every day, to call three other women every day that, you know, whose numbers I got at the meeting the night before. And again, I didn't know. I always thought you wouldn't know who I was when I called. I could have said, hi, I'm Pat, the girl who cried through the entire meeting last night. And I'm certain you would have remembered me. It never occurred to me to say that. So I would dial your number. I'd just be sweating at the idea of you picking up the phone. And you would, and you'd go, hello. And I'd inhale. And in one giant long exhale, I'd say something like, hi, my name is Pat. I have long brown hair and glasses. I'm new. I met you at the meeting last night. My sponsor told me I had to call three people every day, and you're one of them. So how are you anyway? Now, I don't know if anybody even understood a word I said, but they all seemed to get that I was new, and everybody was kind to me. Everybody. One woman in particular, Marianne Kay, and a member of my home group, who's yesterday turned 53 years sober, actually made me laugh in one of those conversations. I mean, I laughed. I couldn't believe it. She remains my dear friend to this very day, you know, and it began in that conversation. I didn't know that all these things were going to help me down the road. You know, I never really got very comfortable with those phone calls. But here's what happened to me. When I was 3 years sober, my husband was really, really sick. He was actually dying of cancer. And I was at the hospital one day, and he'd been sick for a while, some months, I think. And it was just, it was not a day any different than any day before. It was just that day, you know, it was affecting me a lot. And I remember being at the hospital thinking, I can't do this anymore. I didn't feel like drinking. I wanted to run away from my life. I don't know. I just remember thinking, I can't do this. And the thought ran through my head that I probably should call somebody in AA. So I stepped into, there was a payphone in, this is a long time ago. There was a payphone in the intensive care waiting room. And so I stepped into the booth and I called my sponsor who was not home. This was long before voicemail. Nobody had answering machines. It just rang and rang and nobody answered. And I hung up without even thinking about it. I put the dime back in the phone. And I had a little phone book that I carried in my purse of AA phone numbers. And I called somebody else. I called 11 people that day before I reached somebody who was at home. Never once did the thought cross my mind to say, oh, screw it, and step out of that phone booth. I just kept dialing until somebody answered. And it's not that the person who answered had any magical thing, you know. It's just that I was talking to another alcoholic. I got to remember for a minute who I am, you know, what's really my primary problem, and to get a little strength to keep going through the day. That's why she had me making those phone calls. You know, every direction I've ever gotten over all the 46 years that I've been sober has had, I think of it as a ripple effect. You know, you don't always see it when you get the direction, but somewhere down the road, if you incorporate that action into your life, it's going to come back in a really wonderful way to help you. And that is certainly true with those phone calls. So my husband and I, just to go back a little bit, we're fighting about AA all the time. It sounds like AA is ruining my marriage. Just to be clear, I've been cheating on him since the day we got married. I mean, we had a terrible marriage because of me, you know, 100% because of me. We just now have a new topic. We're arguing about AA. He thought that I was coming here to meet men. Not a bad guess, actually. I mean, as I said, I've been cheating on him always, and I had noticed there were men in AA, and some of you guys look kind of good to me. And but here's the thing. None of the men in AA appeared to be interested in me, which really hurt my feelings. And it made me mad that my husband was accusing me of something that I was not actually doing right at that minute. I was very indignant about it. How dare you accuse me, you know, like I'm such a virgin. Anyway, we fought a lot about AA. And it was sort of inevitable that one night I would be at a meeting and I would meet a man who looked good to me. I was 10 months sober. The gentleman in question was about 10 minutes sober. I saw him when he came in the room the first night. He had a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head. My heart started to pound. I literally leapt across the chair, pushed that chair into the aisle so I could get close to him to introduce myself. My sponsor noticed all this little interaction and, you know, beckoned me over. And so I go over to my sponsor and she said, Pat, let's not forget you're a married woman. I said, yeah, but I'm so unhappy. And she said, nonetheless, you're married. And as long as you're married, I expect you to act married. I said, okay, I don't see this as a problem. I'll get divorced. She said, no, no. We in Alcoholics Anonymous don't think it's a good idea to make major moves in the first year of sobriety. Stay married, act married. Well, I was obsessed with this man. I mean, come on, why would God get him sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? It seems so clear to me. I don't know why she doesn't see that. His sponsor didn't see it either. But here's what I did. You know, I think of this as the death dance now. It started with we're giving each other those deep, meaningful glances across the AA meeting hall. And then we're kind of brushing up against each other in the coffee line a lot. And then I'm walking to my car. He's walking me to my car after the meeting. And then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting. It's a little complicated to get together because, as you know, I'm married and obviously we can't go to my place. He's a newcomer. He doesn't even have a place. But we're pretty resourceful people and we can make anything happen. I was at the time working at a record company in Hollywood and he was working right down the street in Hollywood at a porn bookstore. And I arranged a long lunch hour at work one day for somebody to cover for me. And he didn't have a car either. So I picked him up at the bookstore and we went to a motel and let's just say we got to know each other better. I dropped him off at the bookstore that afternoon. I was driving back to my office, and it occurred to me in the car that I was 10 months sober, living exactly the way I had always lived. I knew I was in a lot of trouble. I was scared to tell my sponsor what I'd done because she'd been very, very clear in her direction. But I don't want to drink. And so I told my sponsor that night what I did. And she said, you know, Pat, I don't think you're a woman who could cheat on her husband and stay sober. And you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to. But here's the thing. I've never wanted to live that way, drunk or sober. I never wanted to live that way ever. Wanting has never changed a thing in my life, drunk or sober. Wanting has never done a thing. There's always some action. There's something I need to be doing. Here's what I did. A day at a time, I stayed away from that guy. A day at a time, I didn't drive by the bookstore or take his calls or call him. A day at a time, when I saw him in meetings, I shook hands with a locked elbow. If you're new, this means we never got closer than the entire length of my arm. I thought I should explain to him what was happening here. I ran that idea by my sponsor, and she said, oh, no, no, no more conversations. He'll get the idea. Stay away from that guy. I heard her, and I heard also for the very first time that line that is read in almost every meeting I've been to for all these years, half measures avail us nothing. And I knew for me, for this alcoholic, this was going to be the big issue I was going to live or die on. I knew it. And I knew I would 100% would have to do what she was asking me to do, or I was absolutely most certainly going to drink. And so I stayed away from that guy. Of course, the obsession passed eventually. They always do. But the really good news for me is I do not live that way anymore. As I like to say, you're looking at me now. If you've done the math, you're figuring out that I'm 76 years old, and you're thinking, well, of course you don't live that way anymore, for God's sake. So just to be clear, I haven't lived that way since I was 31 years old. And what a gift. I never imagined in my wildest dreams that I could change to that degree. My first sponsor drank when I was a year and a half sober. I got a new sponsor right away. She was sober a long time. And she said, you know, I've watched you whine and complain about your marriage. I don't want to listen to it. You owe a lot of amends to that guy. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is pretty clear on these difficult amends. It says right in black and white in the step there, you can't go make direct amends, but to do so might injure that person or others. That means, Pat, you cannot go home and say, oh, hey, by the way, I've been cheating on you for 10 years and I'm so sorry. You know, that's not an amend. Now, making amends is making things right. She said, I would suggest to you that you just start acting like you're a kind and loving wife. Maybe you can make some amends that way. She said, I don't know what's going to happen to your marriage. Maybe you will have to walk away. But if you do this in the meanwhile, you might be able to do it without guilt if you do have to leave at some point. And so I became willing to follow her direction. She gave me some pretty specific things to do, ways to talk to him. And I started watching couples in AA, how they treat each other with kindness and consideration. And I tried to take that stuff home and practice it. It sounds so easy when I'm, you know, talking like this. Believe me, there were good days, bad days. But gradually, things got a little better. And I was on my knees. I don't know how long I was doing it until one night I was on my knees and I was thanking God for my sobriety. And I realized I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it didn't happen that particular day. It had already happened. This was the biggest problem in my life. And I hadn't noticed that it had gone away. It had disappeared. I remember getting back down on my knees that night and thanking God for, I wasn't even sure what I was feeling, but I remember saying, thank you, God. I believe if you mean for me to stay married to this man, I could do that and stay sober and have a happy life. Thank you. Not long after that, we found out that he had cancer. He was sick for a year and a half and he died. It was a hard year and a half, but it was the best year and a half of our marriage. Far and away the best year and a half of our marriage. I was so grateful that I had stayed when all of my best judgments said I should get out. I was glad that I was there and believable. You know what I'm saying? Like, he knew I was there because I wanted to be there, not just because he was sick and needed me. Because I'd been there consistently in a loving manner leading up to the point where he got sick. I was so, so grateful that I had stayed. But when he died, I went to a little chapel and made some funeral arrangements, and a couple of hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous took the afternoon off from work to be there. They did not know him, but they came. They knew me, obviously, and they came to support me. And I realized that what my sponsor had promised had happened, that I knew, as sad as I felt that day, I knew 100% I had made my amends to him. And I was so, so grateful that I had stayed. So grateful. And I remember thinking, that's the payoff, you know, for doing the work. I get to feel this, to know for sure that that amend is made. That's part of it. but that's only part. You know, God's vision is way bigger than anything I can ever imagine at any given time. After he passed away, I started dating a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a man that I'd known in meetings for 3 years. He was just a friend, you know. We became better friends and dated and fell in love and got married, and we had almost 30 really great years together. See what I mean about God's vision? You know, I could not have, if you had said to me when I was a year sober, here's what's going to happen. Your husband's going to pass away. You're going to fall in love with Vince and get married and have this fabulous life. I would have said, oh, don't be silly. That's Vince. He's my friend. Go figure. You know, I also know, you know, I would not have attracted a man of Vince's quality had I not done the stuff that I did with my former husband. I also, looking at the time here, I also want to say something else about the incident with the guy with cheating on my husband. That day that I, you know, that I went, you know, picked him up at the bookstore and we went and got to know each other. I had a coworker at work who covered for me because I'd taken this long lunch hour, right? And she covered for me. She knew where I was going and she knew what I was doing because we talked about it when I got back to the office. About a year after that, I got a different job and I left that company, but I stayed in touch with that woman. We'd have lunch occasionally. And then later on, I heard through a third mutual friend that this first lady's husband had developed a drinking problem and she had taken him off to some church in the hopes that his drinking might be addressed. And when I heard that, I remember thinking, gosh, that's weird. I wonder why she didn't go to Al-Anon or take him to an AA meeting. I told her a lot about AA. We talked about it a lot. Well, I did talk about it, but what I showed her about Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's a place where people cheat on their spouses. I don't imagine she would be too excited for her husband to go there, you know? It made me really, for the first time, hear the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it says right in our traditions, this is a program of attraction. I did not make it an attractive place for that family to go. I hope that guy got sober someday. If he did, it's no thanks to me, for sure. But it's made me very aware of how I behave out there in the world, so to speak. If I'm going to let people out there know that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have an obligation to behave in a way that's going to make it an attractive place for them to want to go or send somebody that they love. And I really feel strongly about that one. Anyway, to go on. So as I said, Vince and I had, you know, a lot of great years together. We were both very active members of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsored a lot of people. And our house was always filled with alcoholics. And, you know, we had lots of good parties and things there. And just such, you know, like, a good life, a really good life. And then he died. And I couldn't believe it. I really honestly couldn't believe it. I kind of went in shock for a couple of years, I think. I mean, I still did everything that I do. I went to lots of meetings. I actually upped my meetings. I know what to do when you're hurting. You know, you add a couple of meetings to your week. And so I did that. And I did everything that anybody asked me to do. I said yes. Even if it sounded like a terrible idea, not just AA stuff, but anything. Somebody said, you want to go roller skating? Which sounds like a horrible idea, but yes, of course, I'll do anything. And I got through it with your help. I got through it. You walked me through it. You know, we don't do anything here alone. I guess maybe a really important thing I have to say here is the importance of a home group, because I was in the middle of a big home group and they surrounded me and they pulled me along with them to do all these things so that I didn't wind up sitting home just thinking about myself and how sad my poor little tragic life now was, you know, and my life is not tragic at all, as much as I still miss him today, but my life is good and full. And, you know, I'm grateful that I had all those wonderful years with him. Not everybody gets a great love in their life. And I feel so fortunate that I got that, you know, really, really fortunate. When he died, I kept working for a couple more years and then I retired and I moved out to Palm Desert for, I guess, 10 or 11 years. And it was great. I liked it. But I just recently, a year ago, moved back to the LA area because I realized how much I missed my home group. There's plenty of good meetings out in the desert, but they weren't my home group. And they don't really have, where I was living, they didn't really have a home group sense. They had a lot of good meetings, but no real groups, if you get what I'm saying. And so I realized how much I missed that. And so I'm glad to be back where I can be attending, you know, meetings with my people. I love that God has shown up in my life because I've sought him. You know, I've never had trouble praying, but I said for years, oh yeah, I don't meditate. It's just not me. And I said that to my sponsor one time and she said, oh, so you actually don't do the 11th step. I said, well, no, that's not actually what I said. I pray. And she said, well, it says prayer and meditation in there. And I thought, oh, I got to up my game here a little bit. She's right. And so I started trying to meditate. I had always envisioned it as, you know, sitting cross-legged and saying om or something. I don't know, you know, I just can't really. But I started reading books about meditation, and then there was an AA meditation meeting in the desert. And I thought, oh, I'll go to that. That's a good idea. So I went to that, and everybody's sitting in a circle on chairs, and they had the bowl thing, you know, where they, people who do, you know, you guys know what I'm talking about. And so it's a lovely sound. And so we're all sitting and we do, I don't know, 15 minutes of silence while they're doing the bowl thing. And everybody's sitting quietly with their eyes closed. I am twitching. Everything itches. I'm constantly adjusting my glass, everything. I'm just like, I'm like a newcomer sitting in this chair. I could not sit still. I was so embarrassed. So of course I never went back. I know better than that. I know better than that. I tell people all the time, do not dismiss a meeting on one visit only. You know, give it at least three. But I did. I never went back. I haven't been back to this day. But I kept reading books, and I tried some, you know, YouTube stuff. And then one day, a friend of mine in the desert is very good friends with a guy who is or was, I don't know if he still is, an assistant to the Dalai Lama. And he happened to be visiting his mother, I guess, lived in the desert. And so he happened to be visiting his mother. And so my friend said, would you have dinner and talk to a couple of us about meditation? And he said, sure. And so I went over there, and there's like four of us and him, five of us maybe and him. And so, I mean, this is a real opportunity here, you know, to talk to somebody about meditation. And so he talked to us about meditation and gave us some, you know, brief, short meditations to do and how to do it. And I thought, oh, this is good. This kind of works for me. And I could see this kind of working for me. And so, you know, he left. And so I started doing a 2-minute meditation. He said, just start, you know, start with a little bit. So I did 2 minutes. And after a week or so, I thought, wow, that time just goes by in a flash. So I'll do 4 minutes. And so I did 4 minutes. And pretty soon that went by in a flash. And I thought, oh, I'm just going to do a half an hour. So I did a half an hour, and then I never meditated again, you know, because that's what I do. You know, I can't just follow the directions. I mean, you got to beat me over the head with this stuff. So I'm back to sort of square one with doing 3 minutes. And, you know, I do find I'm a hiker. And so I do actually a lot of meditation when I'm hiking. I listen to people, you know, things that they say. Somebody said this thing that about meditating. They say, welcome, welcome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. When I'm hiking, I breathe in to a count of four and I breathe out to a count of eight. So it's welcome, welcome is breathing in. And thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you is breathing out. It works perfectly. And I do that a lot when I'm hiking. And that, you know, just kind of calms my mind and gets, you know, puts my mind on that. So anyway, I'm doing the best I can. And apparently it's good enough at the moment because God does keep showing up in my life, you know, and I'll just talk briefly about a couple of things. When I was 10 years sober, Vince and I lived in Pasadena, and to get to work, I had to go down the Pasadena Freeway, past the Dodger Stadium, through downtown LA, and circle around to my office. And it's Los Angeles traffic. It's terrible. And so every day, a little ways before Dodger Stadium, the traffic on the freeway would slow to pretty much a complete stop, and then it would just creep, you know, 2 miles an hour through downtown. And every day I'm in the car, I'm clutching that steering wheel. I'm cursing God, you, everybody in every other car. I'm the person that's darting in and out of the traffic like that lane's going to be better, you know, the one you hate. I did that every day for at least a year, I'm sure, at least a year, until one day I'm in the car and sure enough, the traffic stops and I'm all tensed up. And I happen to glance over to the right, and down the embankment of the freeway is Figueroa Boulevard, and across Figueroa is a bar that I worked in. I just came from a really nice house in Pasadena where the mortgage is current. There's a husband there who loves and respects me. I'm going to an office where they think I'm great. When I get off work today, I'm going to go to an AA meeting. I'm going to see my sponsor and see some women that I sponsor. I'm going to enjoy a good AA meeting, and I'm going to go home after that meeting with my own husband. I am not the same woman who did the things that I did in that bar and in the parking lot behind that bar. you can't get from down there to up here. And yet here I am. I started to cry in the car that day. I was so overwhelmingly grateful for my life. I really saw clearly how much Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I've had many, many, I like to just call them God moments, moments where there is absolutely 100% no doubt whatsoever that God is working in my life. And I could talk another 45 minutes just on that alone. I won't, because I'm looking at the clock and I see that my time is up. I just want to say that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being here. I love the way that I get to live my life. Thank you so much for inviting me to share.